From KHOI in Story City, Ames, I'm Chris Fiviora, and this is Book Central, the show that interviews authors from the Central Time Zone. My guest today is Anne Valente, author of the debut novel Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down, which charts a high school yearbook staff's reactions after a school shooting and then follows mysterious house fires that rage through the suburbs. Anne grew up in St. Louis, and now she teaches at Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Anne Valente, welcome to Book Central.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
Anne, before reading your novel, I considered a yearbook as a time capsule. Then I read the yearbook staff characters say this, a record, what it means to archive, to set down disaster. Now I wonder, how did you consider a yearbook, and did writing this novel change your perception of its purpose?
It did, yes. I think I initially had the idea for a school shooting and the fires and didn't come to the yearbook immediately, and I was trying to find the right framework to talk about that. And I was not on the yearbook staff in high school. I knew very, very little about creating a yearbook. But ended up doing some research into just how they're put together, how many staff members there are, what kind of work goes into building a yearbook. And it ended up being the right framework for me just because it contends so much with memory and with putting down a record of what happened. And I just couldn't get out of my mind how a group of high schoolers would put together their yearbook if something like this happened at their school, especially since yearbooks are supposed to record the best moments, generally speaking, of the highlights of the year. So that kind of became the structure for the book in terms of thinking about how to put down the information.
And so what was your perception then of a yearbook before writing this book versus after? Did you two think that it was just a time capsule of opening it of good memories, and then now it's about recording what has happened regardless of the kind of emotion?
I think so, yeah. I mean, my touchstone, I think, with most people who went through junior high and high school and didn't actually work on the yearbook was simply, here's a record of memories, here's a book of faces, here's a place to have a bunch of signatures of people that, you know, 15 years later, you may remember some of them, you may not remember some of them. But yeah, I mean, I think in the time since writing this book, now I think of it in a different way of just sort of a time capsule in general, you know, and whether or not that's a true time capsule, I think is something that I think this book contends with a little bit of how we want to remember things and how things actually were, which I think is a question for any yearbook. But with this particular topic, I was really interested in how that might shift across a year if something kind of terrible happens.
Hmm. And, you know, one of your four main characters, Matt, he's a writer, junior yearbook staffer, and he saw the body of one of his murdered classmates. He says, I have no idea how we're going to put this together, this being the yearbook and the aftermath of all that. I wondered about what Matt said as I read your novel's narrative, because it was interspersed with newspaper articles, yearbook profiles, electric wiring, house prints, medical examiner reports. How did you know the structure of your book before writing it, or how did you figure out how to put this book together as you wrote it?
That's a good question, and I think, to be honest, I was a little bit afraid of the topic, just in terms of the weight of it. I didn't necessarily want to create this overarching authoritative voice that was mine, that really said, you know, this is the story, this is how everybody felt about it, you know, this is how everybody did or didn't move on. I think I was really hesitant to be that central voice, so I think that's where all of those different strands came from, was to create a much more multi-voiced narrative of just coming up with all of these different ways of different pieces of information. I think even just the way that people's brains work in general to try to archive things and make sense of them is pulling from various different sources. So I think I was trying to tap into that too, of just creating multiple sources of information between four different main characters, but also, you know, as you say, diagrams, house prints, profiles of various students. I think all of those things, I hope, created a much more nuanced view of this and what happens throughout the book.
So did you always have these four characters that you expected to braid all together, or you know, were you working on the individual research and then you thought, how am I going to put all this together into a book?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Some of that came from yearbook research in general, of just how many people per year, per academic year in a high school are working on the yearbook. And that sort of lent itself to four different main characters. But I really did want to explore the maybe four separate ways of dealing with grief or trying to move on, as opposed to just one central narrative or central individual. And that's sort of how the yearbook came to be as well. Beyond just thinking about structure, how can I explore exactly how a community like this moves on through four different points of view?
Did you actually assign different roles of grief to certain characters?
To some extent, I did. And that was never something that was written down in my notes of, you know, Zola will react this way or Matt will react this way. But it really came more out of, you know, who are each of these individuals? What are their relationships? What are some of the things that they were contending with in their personal lives before any of this happened? And how are they sort of navigating that with this larger overarching grief that their entire community is experiencing? And I think that kind of lent itself more so than anything else to, well, you know, this person would react this way, or this person would sort of bottle it up, or this person would have explosions of anger. So I think it kind of came out of trying to understand them as characters.
And I've heard a short story described as a hot air balloon ride. A couple people fit in, go up, come back down relatively in the same place. A novel, though, is a jet. I mean, you can have a lot of seats. You can travel pretty far. So in addition to these four yearbook staffers and their parents and their siblings, your novel contained more than 30 victims and their families, all who I got to know rather well. How did you keep track of your cast?
That's a good question.
Did you give them seat assignments? I mean...
Structure was definitely, or just organization, I guess, was definitely something that I had to pin down in this novel. And I think that's completely apt in terms of comparing a short story to a novel. And this actually began as a short story. It's the only piece that I've ever written that felt like it could be a larger narrative.
Oh.
So it started as a short story where I did not explore all of those individual lives. I just knew this many people had been killed, but it was largely a collective first narrative centering on actually an elementary school. But in terms of building a novel, I really had a number of charts, just visual maps of, you know, a list of names and where they were in the school when they were killed. And then these four individual characters and everybody in their family, I just had maps all over my office to just really sort of keep track of it. But beyond that, of just a list, you know, I really wanted to sort of imagine who they were as people, to not create just a list. I mean, I hope part of the point of the book is to not view a list like this as a list. So some of that really did require just sort of digging and imagining their lives beyond what we might have seen in a newspaper.
Right. It's a community of people, for sure, mm-hmm. that everyone has some kind of overlapping relationship. All the staffers knew someone who died or saw someone who had died. Zola, one of the other staffers that you mentioned before, the photographer, who can't capture any new images, she's one who actually is in the fray of all of it, of the carnage. Going back just for a second to the structure, I was really curious about it. I love to hear, and I think the audience does too, love to hear about what that looks like in your office. What did all these maps, I mean, did this like cover a wall? You had post-it notes? What did it look like, Anne?
I did. Yeah, no, it was one large sort of paper poster board map just of the timeline. So it takes place in October of 2003 across 2 weeks. So I created just a calendar
okay.
Of world events that were happening at that time, national events, but then little notes about what happened on each specific day among the characters that I have across those 2 weeks of time. But then that was sort of the main motherboard, if you will, I guess, of maps. But then alongside of it, I had a number of other papers of, you know, a diagram of the school and a list of the names and the year that they were, whether they were freshmen or whether they were seniors, the staff, the librarians, all of their names and a little bit about their background, too. And then beyond that, a number of sheets of just information about crime scene investigation, but also fire investigation. And even this sounds so small, I think, or even ridiculous, but just a list of synonyms for fire, because writing a novel, I didn't want to be too repetitive with some of the language that the novel uses. So even things from just macro plot-wise structure, sort of notes to myself all the way down to language and how to not keep using the same words. I just had that sort of papered around my office for about a year.
Wow. And then you had to take it all down.
Yes. Yes, I still have those notes in a folder, but they are no longer on my walls.
Yeah. I remember a friend who had just post-it notes across the wall, and she had her main narrative in post-it notes of one color, and then she kind of had the spikes of action above it, the horizontal line, and then kind of the internal rumblings underneath it. And it was this visualization that I thought, wow, that's got to be super helpful. And it sounds like your calendar, especially you've got these 2 weeks of events that are going on, really helped you see the timeline of what was going on then.
Yes. Yeah, and I think I'm visual in general and sort of need to see it. I imagine post-its are helpful, too, to just be able to move them around.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't think of that. I might do that for another novel. But yeah, having a map and a calendar was really helpful.
And, you know, I want to also hear about some of the influences that went into this book. One of my favorite books is, I think it's pretty much Chicago set, Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris, about the shuttering of a soap opera-like office, which actually includes an office shooting scare. That novel is written in first person plural. The narration, like yours, most of yours, I guess, is written collectively as we. So what first person plural books were you reading before and during your writing, maybe even after now? People might be recommending books to you all the time. After writing Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down.
Sure. I'm really drawn to short stories that are written in the collective first, but I did absolutely look to examples of novels, since I know it can be a more difficult collective voice to maintain across the jet of the novel as opposed to the hot air balloon. But, I mean, Joshua Ferris's novel was definitely one that had an influence on me when I first read it. I think the two books that I point to, though, that were very influential for me were Jeffrey Eugenides' The Virgin Suicide, which is told in collective first, and sort of a retrospective collective first as well, sorting to piece together this mystery. So I think I took a lot from that structure of just sort of trying to figure something out and creating an archive of figuring that out. And also, I don't know that this entirely fits, because I think it branches off into first person as well, like just singular first. But Joyce Carol Oates' Foxfire was also really important to me when I first began writing. It's about a girl gang, and it kind of in parts told in the collective first, of just a group moving around a community together. And it's very much told from an individual's perspective who joins that group, but something about the group. There were sections of collective narration that I think maybe the direct tie to this book, the book that I wrote, is that it is centered on a group of high school students, just capturing that collective immediacy of youth, I think, is what was helpful for me.
I found it really interesting that you brought up that this started as a short story, and I'm not sure how common or not that is in short stories to write collective first person. Were there some stories that you were modeling your original story after, or were just helping you as you continue to develop these chapters?
I don't know. I can't think of too many short stories off the top of my head. I know that there are a few in mind that I teach sometimes that are a little bit more contemporary. Like Molly Patterson's Honors Track is a collective first short story that is just about a group of high schoolers on the honors track, kind of creating this heist of cheating, and trying to figure out who it was who cheated in their class. Claire Beams, she has a short story collection that just came out this fall. And her short story, We Show What We Have Learned, is also a collective first. That's really interesting just to look at. It's a group of students watching their teacher literally decompose sort of piece by piece. it's very short, but I think those, and again, you know, just in terms of my curation, I guess, both of those are about youth and high schoolers as well. So I think those are kind of helpful for me too, and just thinking about this age where you're sort of starting to become your own person, but you're also still part of a collective and a group. So I think those have been interesting for me to read, but also just interesting to study to see how to sustain it across a short story and then how to branch that over into a novel.
Sure.
Well,
and there's even a lineage of novels about school shootings, or there's definitely ones about shootings. School shootings, I think, are an even more specific focus. One of these that I knew of before would be Project X by Jim Shepard, which focuses on the killer kids rather than their student victims, leading all the way up to the planning of Project X's the shooting. Your novel, though, focuses less on the why of the shooting, more on the how the community deals with the tragedy. Did you choose to write the aftermath rather than the lead up into the tragedy? Or I guess maybe, did you ever at one point decide to write from the killer's point of view and then nix it? I guess I'm asking, how did you choose which side to follow?
That's a great question. And it's actually one that I gave considerable thought to in how I decided to structure this book. I actually don't have any examples of other books that I've read about school shootings or shootings in general, because I think I consciously sort of tried to avoid them. I know that they're out there and I know the titles, but I didn't actually read them because I think given a lot of the news that we've seen, you know, even since, you know, Columbine in the 90s, every time that there's a shooting, I feel like we focus tremendously on the shooter and the shooter's objective. And then we focus on that for a period of weeks and then we sort of pull away. And I think what I'm usually left wondering is what happens to the community and how do they move on or do they not move on? And I really just kind of, I did make the deliberate choice to not focus on the shooter. I know the first 16 pages of the novel, the first opening chapter deals with the shooting, but then the rest of it is the aftermath. And I think that's what I wanted to focus on, is not shooter motive, and not centering that, but really centering the community and who this affects, as opposed to trying to figure out motive.
Huh. So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Book Central.
Hands
Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. If you're just joining me on Book Central, my guest today is Anne Valente, author of the novel Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down. Before the break, we were talking about the structure of writing collective tragedy. Anne, your novel includes a school shooting and house fires, as well as young love and boredom of days off. As a teacher of writing, what's your policy on trigger warnings?
That's a good question. This has actually been quite a discussion at the university I teach, which is Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and just whether to include them, whether to not include them. I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion across institutions in the past few years about this. And I think that, you know, regardless of a set policy at any institution, when you're about to discuss potentially, you know, controversial material or potentially harmful or hurtful material, I think it's good to just create some kind of preference. I mean, we do this all the time in our movie ratings to let people know what they're about to see. And, you know, that I don't think that trigger warnings mean don't pay attention to this, don't read this, don't listen to this. I don't think it means don't engage with it. I think it simply means be aware. So I do let students know when we're going to be dealing with difficult material. I don't think that means censorship, and I don't believe in censorship, but I do believe in letting people know what they are about to engage with, especially if it's potentially violent or potentially traumatizing in any way.
So would that be your definition of a trigger warning? Anything that's violent or potentially damaging?
Yeah, I think potentially damaging in multiple ways. And I think we can't, for me at least as a teacher, I can't necessarily predict what will be triggering and what won't. It could be things that aren't violent at all. But I think it's simply letting students know what they are about to read or what we're in for, whether it's a video or whether it's a poem, whether it's a story, just letting them know what we're about to engage with.
I'm thinking back to my own school, and maybe you can chime in too about this, is I didn't have trigger warnings. I can't necessarily consider a time where it was necessary. Do you remember a time where you wished that you had had a warning about what you were reading?
Yeah, I didn't either. It was definitely not something that was discussed when I was in high school or in college. I think, and I don't know if that's just that we're becoming more aware of the possibility of harmful or traumatic material or if it's something else, but I agree. I can't think of a time when I would have needed it, but at the same time, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be a bit more aware of the individuals in a room and how they might react to something.
I guess where I'm going with this is my concern that it's being laid on a teacher who already has enough responsibility to set up a class versus it seems pretty easy in our age to look up a synopsis or to read a summary of something to know whether or not it would confront them with something. So I do find it interesting that the responsibility is laid at the teacher's feet rather than the student who should be teaching themselves.
Right. No, and I think it's a fine line. And I say often in class that I'm most certainly not, you know, I have no basis or grounds for being a therapist or knowing at all what will be triggering or harmful. I
sure.
always refer students elsewhere for that. You know, my job is strictly content and discussion of that content. But yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing discussion and one that, you know, I'm not sure where we will go with this in institutions, but I mean, I do agree that I there needs to be student responsibility as well to sort of know what's coming. But for me, as the person who's sort of in charge of what content I'm delivering, I do want them to know what they're about to read.
Sure. Absolutely. That makes sense. You mentioned a really great point is that sometimes it's not the violence or things that we might think are harmful. I wonder if it's just as important to mention the peace within writing, that sometimes there's not going to be intense action, that there might be lulls in the narrative. Do you ever talk about that with students? Maybe more with their own work than something you're assigning them.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And just that those, for me at least, I think those beats of silence or lulls are necessary. You know, and I don't know if this is a great analogy, but sometimes we end up talking about it in terms of action films, since Marvel films are so popular right now.
Yeah.
And many students are very interested in those. It's very difficult to sustain 2 hours of action, or even, you know, a 20-minute action scene, that you need smaller moments or beats between characters where we understand a little bit more about them just by how they drink coffee or how they watch television,
sure.
Just things that seem kind of mundane. So I think that, yeah, obviously, you know, outside of action narratives too, I think just in terms of pacing, yes, I think those lulls and those beats are necessary to give the reader a breather or the audience a breather, but also to understand silence a little bit more, and not always privilege the more action-based scenes and sequences.
And maybe to look at the noun rather than the adjective of superhuman, of what's the humanity of these, you know, heroes.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Can they be anything other than a god who is never fallen, who is invincible, that there's nothing at stake, that the world will return to good after they've destroyed it? Yeah, that's interesting that a lot of your students, and I'm sure that's pretty consistent, is come from more exposure to film than to reading. But it's maybe their own lives that they should write the most about, like whether or not they were on a yearbook staff, to go back to that. I did wonder about the characters on the yearbook staff. They seem to come to this moment where they hold a responsibility to honor the memories of those lost, even though they can't find out anything more about them. The other writer on the yearbook staff team is Christine, I think it is. And she just kind of has this writer's block and eventually does write a little bit about some of those students who are lost. I wondered, though, on the flip side, what's the responsibility that you found as a novelist to write about tragedy, about violence?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think you never know if you're the right person to write about something. And I think past the point, I didn't even know what that meant anymore. I just knew that I needed to address it. I think just because this was bothering me so much in culture, of the way that these instances of mass violence were being covered and how we know very little about the communities. I mean, obviously there are interviews at times with different members of communities, but by and large, I feel like it's easy to forget them. And so I don't know. I think part of my task as a novelist, beyond just the macro of covering this topic in general, was looking a bit further into these characters and not necessarily I don't know, blanketing their lives in a whitewashed kind of way. I think that's what these yearbook staffers are struggling with a little bit too, is when you memorialize someone, do you remember only the best things about them, or do you also remember that maybe you didn't like this person very much, or they were kind of mean in class, or they did something to you in elementary school that you can't forget, or, you know, there's a brief scene in the book of just kind of talking about how to lay out these memorializations and who should go next to who, and, you know, this person cheated on this person, so they can't go together on the same page. So kind of remembering all of those things too, that they are real people and were real people, instead of only trying to remember the best aspects of them.
It's like a seating assignment again.
Right. Exactly.
And yeah, I mentioned this just when we were talking before we got you on the air, was that this struck home for me because I was a freshman when 9/11 happened, but then I was about the age of your staffers when this happened in your book. So I was probably a sophomore, maybe a junior in 2003 when this was set. I even worked on not the yearbook, but the newspaper staff.
Okay.
You mentioned a few times that you did not work on the yearbook staff, but you went back and kind of researched how yearbooks were put together. Did you go back to your own school? I'm sure you opened up your own yearbooks, but what was your process of figuring out how a yearbook is put together?
I did go back and look at my yearbooks, and I looked at my husband's yearbooks too,
Ooh.
Just to see what some of the differences were between high schools. He also grew up in the Midwest in central Illinois. So just two test cases, two sort of random test cases of a set of four yearbooks from two Midwestern high schools helped a little bit by just looking at the credits and who worked on those yearbooks and how many people worked on them. But yeah, I mean, I'd never actually, I don't think I've been back to my high school since I graduated. Which is not to say that I didn't go back to St. Louis and do some research there, just, you know, suburban St. Louis and kind of getting a feel for that again, because it's been a while since I've lived there. But yeah, just looking at actual yearbooks from my own past and my husband's past, but also just kind of looking around online at other schools' yearbooks to see how they were put together was helpful.
And I mean, I don't know whether or not, you know, you'll go back to your high school. That would be pretty interesting with this book. But one of your yearbook staffers asked his parents, did you ever know anyone who died as a kid? And this is another thing that as I was reading it, it just kind of brought up some things. And I did not need a trigger warning for reading the book. But it was good for me to confront was that I did remember a friend who had accidentally shot himself. But I wondered, did you ask that question of your parents, of other people, of yourself? Did you know anyone who died as a kid?
That actually was not part of my research process or putting this book together. But it's something that I wonder about, and I think that particular scene that you're talking about was helpful for me in just opening up some of the questions that I think would arise when if something like this happened in your community as a high schooler, especially since I think as high schoolers, at least maybe I'm speaking for myself, but you tend to think mostly of your world and
sure.
the surroundings of that world. And I don't know if it would take something like this to really think about your parents and that they too were once 15 and 16 and that maybe something like this happened when they were high schoolers. So I think I was trying to find the points of opening up, I guess, instead of closing down of how something like this could potentially make the characters think beyond themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, it's interesting. I'm not sure if it's Matt, who I think is the one who asked this question, but I know one of the other staffers doesn't really know what their parents do. I kind of generally like is a doctor and a lawyer, but nothing specific. And it is this self-centered time, I guess, where you're figuring out who you are as a person in high school. Did this book take you back to who you were as a high schooler?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. And I don't know. I think in part it made me think about the structure of my high school and how maybe I was fortunate to not really, at least from my perspective, I'm sure other people who I went to high school with think differently, but I felt as if it wasn't necessarily a high school that was full of sort of stereotypical camps, of people needing to be in one certain camp or the other. So I think that kind of channeling that a little bit helped me think a bit more about what a community might look like, of people who are just who care about one another, who don't care about one another. There's not really a sense of bullying or of abiding by strict social stereotypes, I guess. I kind of just wanted to get into personalities and how this community looks. So I think even little things ended up being important in writing this book, like a chance conversation with somebody who is in one of your classes, but you never actually talk to very much. I tried to incorporate a few scenes like that of just how this might create further connections between people who otherwise wouldn't really associate with one another.
Right. I mean, there's one scene where there's a wrestler who, I think it's again Matt, and maybe I'm following him the most in the book because he's the writer, but he has a panic attack or just a kind of anxiety. He can't breathe in the bathroom. And this wrestler is basically comforting this yearbook staffer. And you think, man, wouldn't those worlds be colliding? But they're both these high schoolers who are in the aftermath of this tragedy.
Yeah, and I think I think especially in revision of the book, those things became more important of trying to draw connections between people of just what the scale of tragedy can do that's terrible, but also even small things that might create connections that otherwise wouldn't have been there. Two people who would never have spoken to each other, but now have something in common.
And you mentioned a little bit about this before, about memorializing that. It made me think about what it takes to memorialize somebody. And I've given the eulogy of a grandparent's funeral before, and that's, nonfiction. But I think you got to do the good and the bad, or not the bad, but make them a real person, things that might have been a little frictional with people. I wondered though, with writing fiction of the, not necessarily the memorializing, but in writing fiction, is it still the same feeling as trying to contain memory with language? Or what was it to write a fictional account of death and tragedy? What was language's tool to, I don't know, to capture that, to contain that?
Yeah, I think that was my struggle, I think, throughout the entire book, is that regardless of fiction or nonfiction, when writing about grief, so much of the words that you have to contain that end up feeling inadequate in some way. And I think that that is what I struggled with as a writer, sort of on the meta level of writing this out, but also that I think the characters are contending with too, that language ultimately, since that's what a yearbook is made of, is just a string of words to memorialize somebody, I think ends up coming up no matter how you try to write it, feeling empty or regardless or worthless in some way, or not quite touching the surface of what it is that you actually mean. And I think that's kind of the struggle, I guess, of any writer in general is I think I wondered throughout writing this entire book, am I finding the right words to express this? And, I don't know. I don't know if I did that or not, but I think that it was one way of approaching a first novel is have the writers sort of, the writers within the book also contend with this question.
Yeah, I mean, a community can definitely cleave in different ways after a tragedy. Sometimes that means coming together or they're torn apart, that they grieve in different ways, disassociate, or dwell with death. We're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back. Before the break on Book Central, I was talking to my guest, Anne Valente, about the responsibility and memory of tragedy and death. Anne's novel, Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down, follows the response after a high school shooting. Anne, your chapters between the novel's narrative moment begin with the subtitle, A Brief History. These chapters explore science and technique of investigations. When did you come up with that clause, a brief history, in your writing process, and how did you want those chapters to work?
So I think those chapters initially began as sort of vague thoughts, I suppose, from what I imagined as Nick's perspective of the four on the yearbook staff. Nick is the researcher. He's not a writer. He's not a photographer, but his job is to just do research. Which I imagine just for a regular year, a yearbook staff would be researching news events, and what to include and to write up the chart of the year of what happened. But his mind sort of turns towards crime scene investigation and then fire investigation once these fires begin to occur. And I think in drafting the book, created just sections within the regular narrative chapters where that information came in, but it ended up sounding kind of forced in some ways, like it was just an information dump. And as a writer who came from short fiction and still writes short fiction, but also wrote flash fiction, that ended up being kind of an easy way to break up the narrative, to get back to this more multi-voiced perspective that I initially conceived of, but also just to create these shorter chapters that convey some of that information. But I think in large part what ended up creating those brief history chapters was that while I was doing some research, I was really taken by the poetic language that is used to describe some of these more scientific processes, like sublime being a word that describes a transition in fire, can't even think off the top of my head, but just some of the other things that just kind of came up in that research were actually really beautiful. And when they were found just in textbooks on fire investigation and crime scene investigation. So I think I let myself play with the language a little bit in those shorter sections.
And the novel takes place back in October 2003. That's our timeline is 2 weeks there, about a dozen years ago. And like I've said, I enjoyed returning to the past. I went to high school from 2001 to 2005, and you included all these blips from the aughts, many of it pop culture, like Mariah Carey on the Billboard music charts. But how did you return to the past as you wrote it? I mean, you are the researcher for your book. So what was your research process like?
I initially knew that I wanted to set it sometime in the past, to be honest, before smartphones, because I just didn't want to deal with students texting each other, students looking stuff up on their phones. But that was a very thin reason. I ultimately, and it could have been any time before smartphones, but I ended up picking October of 2003 just because the search for weapons of mass destruction was happening at that time, sort of culminating in this lack of actually finding anything. And so I zeroed in on that time just because it was 2 years after September 11th and this time where I think we were very uncertain anyway as a nation, but very much looking for answers. And that ended up being a good backdrop for a community that was trying to do the same thing. But then even just smaller things like Mariah Carey being on the billboards or even the Steve Bartman incident during the playoffs and World Series that year ended up actually being really interesting ways to just briefly weave those things into the narrative of even having these four staffers react of, like, I can't believe that people are making this big of a deal out of a baseball, given that, you know, what's happening in our community. So there were some interesting things happening at that time that ended up being a good use to the narrative.
Were there things that you didn't know about beforehand during that time period versus things that you re-remembered from that time period?
There were definitely things that I didn't know about. I think there's a mention kind of in the last chapter of this Halloween solar storm that happened, which was which caused sort of a power outage in a city at that particular time. And I knew nothing about that, but it ended up serving the narrative in a very small way in that particular moment. But yeah, I mean, I think even just the timeline of, you know, searching for weapons of mass destruction, I think I obviously remembered that that was happening, but didn't know the exact timeline of that. So I think re-researching a lot of those things, even just by day of what was happening on this particular day in 2003, was really helpful to remember.
And of course, October being, you know, not just Halloween, but November 1st being All Saints Day of remembering the dead, all of that culminating together. Were you reading newspapers from that, from, I guess, St. Louis Dispatch and maybe the Times? What was your reading diet like for the research?
I actually use Wikipedia a lot. I know I always tell students, like, never use this for writing a research paper, but it's actually really helpful for creative writing. So I use that a lot just in terms of timeline. But I did look at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch quite a bit just to see how they tend to write their articles, how they structure their pages. But the main news archive that I ended up using the most was the Denver Post. In terms of how they covered
Columbine.
The Columbine shooting. And just, you know, because they have this entire available archive. So really what I was looking for was obviously what happened. And I did not pattern this book exactly after that particular shooting and incident, but I did want to know how a newspaper covered something like that day by day. Mm-hmm. And even just down to, you know, what is the ratio of where a story like this would appear on the front page versus these other things that are happening in the country, in the world.
And I mean, you had to write those newspaper articles in the book. I was surprised that you, and maybe later on you did have some journalism experience, but that you hadn't been on, you know, well, I guess you weren't on your yearbook staff, but did you have any journalism background?
I do. Yeah, okay. I actually went into journalism first and got my master's in journalism before realizing that I would make a terrible journalist.
the Wikipedia research.
Yeah, so I used that of just, you know, the leads and finding the who, what, when, where, and why, and borrowing that language of journalism to create those sections. But I think my lack of skill as a journalist has made me interested as a creative writer in, you know, what is being told in a news story and what is being left out and how much does the journalist actually know? Because I often felt like I didn't know enough as a journalist to actually write the right kind of stories. So I think that has made its way into my fiction.
And, you know, you grew up in St. Louis. You're writing about St. Louis. I'm sure that you returned both literally and imaginatively to the Central Time Zone, specifically the Midwest. St. Louis. You've got this wonderful passage about a St. Louis sound, a Midwestern sound, a wave of noise as August burned off into September, then louder still as autumn deepened into October. Of course, this is the thrum of cicadas. Now that you live out in New Mexico, are there any other senses of this place that you miss or recall or plan to write about?
Absolutely. Yes. I think when I was writing this book, I was living in Cincinnati and then in part out west as well. So writing this was a time of transition, which made me really aware of how different each place is, not just for the obvious reasons of, you know, different stores and different ways of structuring streets and neighborhoods, but just senses of sounds and textures. And I think, I don't know, in part, writing this book was trying to recapture what I grew up with and kind of figuring that out a little bit. I mean, I think, I don't know how other writers feel, but I think having grown up in St. Louis, I grew up with a Midwestern sound. I grew up with cicadas. I grew up in a neighborhood that was less than a mile from the highway, so there was constantly sort of this hum in the background. I think all of those things have infiltrated my sense of the Midwest and also my sense of writing, and I was trying to capture that sensory experience on the page as best as possible. But I think I carry that with me. I don't know that I'll ever have, I mean, maybe I will, I don't know, but I think I still have kind of a St. Louis sound, if that makes sense, living in New Mexico, that I will always carry and bring to my writing. I don't know. While I was writing this book, I wrote a number of short stories about St. Louis as well that ended up becoming kind of their own collection, just because I wanted to get deeper into the setting and the history, and just, even if that never made it into this novel, know more about my city. And so I think for now, like at least right now at this period of time, I'm done for the moment in terms of writing about St. Louis, but I think I'll always return to it. I think that's just in me to write about the Midwest and the central time zone in general.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for talking to me about your research and structure of writing your novel. I really enjoyed going back into the past and visiting St. Louis with you.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Anne Valente is the author of Our Hearts Will Burn Us Down. You've been listening to Book Central. I'm Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett.